Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. We live in a thriller culture. We pack thrillers along on our vacations. We binge watch the shows on TV. Again and again, I've pondered, why is it that thrillers are our go-to genre? The easy answer might be found in today's gut-wrenching headlines. In most thrillers, the bad guys get their just desserts. The ingenuity of the writer is often in finding new settings in which the traditional drama can seem fresh and interesting. Voila, the focus of today's show. We'll preview thrillers set around the globe, from Iceland to Central America. My guest today, Ben Mezrich, stops by to fill us in on his new book, fiction this time, with a central character who may remind you of a certain whip-bearing, rabble-rousing archaeologist. So stay tuned as we turn to page one of the book report. The year is 1829. The place, Northern Iceland. Agnes Magnusdottir is condemned to death for her part in the brutal murder of two men. Agnes is sent away to wait out the months before her execution. She arrives on the farm of District Officer Jon Jonsson, his wife, and their two daughters. Horrified to have a convicted murderess in their midst, the family avoids Agnes. Only Toti, the young assistant priest appointed her spiritual guardian, will listen to Agnes's side of the story. As the year progresses and the hardships of rural life force everyone to work side by side, the family's attitude to Agnes starts to change. Then, one winter night, she begins her whispered confession to them. They realize all is not as they'd assumed. Based on a true story, Hannah Kent's Burial Rites, shortlisted for the 2014 Indie Awards, is an astonishing book about the truths we claim to know and the ways in which we interpret what we're told. Morven Christie narrates.
Public notice. There will be an auction on the 24th of March, 1828, at Idlugastadir, for the valuables the farmer Nathan Kettelsson has left behind. There is one cow, a few horses, a considerable amount of sheep, hay and furniture, a saddle, a bridle, and many dishes and plates. All this will be sold if a decent offer is presented. All valuables will be awarded to the highest bidder. If the auction is not possible due to bad weather, it will be cancelled and held the next day, weather allowing. District Commissioner Björn Blöndal. 20th of March, 1828. To the Very Reverend Johan Thomason. Thank you for your worthy letter from the 14th, where you wish to be informed of how we attended to the burial of Pieter Jonsson from Gaitaskart, who is said to have been murdered and burned on the night between the 13th and the 14th of this month with Nathan Kettelsson. As my reverend is aware, there was some deliberation over whether his bones should be buried in consecrated ground. His conviction and punishment for robbery, theft, and receiving stolen property was to follow after his prosecution in the Supreme Court. However, we have not had any letters from Denmark. The land court judge convicted Pieter on the 5th of February last year and sentenced him to 4 years of hard labour in the Rasmus in Copenhagen, but at the time of his murder he was on free foot. Therefore, in answer to your inquiry, his bones were buried with Christian rites, alongside Nathan's, as he could not yet be thought of as belonging to those outside the Christian way. These people are expressly defined in the letter from His Majesty the King, on the 30th of December, 1740, which lists all persons who shall not be permitted Christian burial rites. District Commissioner Björn Blöndal. 30th of May, 1829. Reverend T. Jonsson, Breda Bolstadur, Vesterhope. To the Assistant Reverend Thorvardur Jonsson. I trust this letter finds you well and thriving in your administration of the Lord's work in Vesterhope. Firstly, I wish to extend you my congratulations, however belatedly, for the successful completion of your studies in the south of Iceland. Your parishioners say that you are a diligent young man, and I approve of your decision to repair to the north to begin your chaplaincy under the supervision of your father. It is of considerable joy to me to know that there remain righteous men willing to fulfil their duties to man and God. Secondly, I, in my capacity as district commissioner, write to you in request of service. As you will be aware, our community has recently been darkened by the shadow of crime. The Idlugastadir murders, committed last year, have in their heinousness emblematized the corruption and ungodliness of this county. As district commissioner for Hunavatn, I cannot abide societal waywardness, and, after the anticipated authorization from the Supreme Court in Copenhagen, I intend to execute the Idlugastadir murderers. It is with this event in mind that I ask for your assistance, Assistant Reverend Thorvaldur. As you will recall, I related the event of the murders in a letter circulated to the clergy almost 10 months ago, with orders that sermons of chastisement be delivered. Allow me to repeat what occurred, this time to provide you with a more invested consideration of the crime. Last year, on the night between the 13th and 14th of March, three people committed a severe and loathsome act against two men with whom you may be familiar, Nathan Kettleson and Pieter Jonsson. Pieter and Nathan were found in the burnt ruins of Nathan's farm, Idlugastadir, and a closer examination of their corpses revealed wounds of a deliberately inflicted nature. This discovery led to an inquiry, and from there, a trial ensued.
We've just heard a sampling of Burial Rites by Hannah Kent. For nearly 2,000 years, the legendary tomb of Alexander the Great and the extraordinary riches within has remained undiscovered. But recent events may hold the key to locating the fabled vault. Only one team has the skills necessary to solve the mystery that has confounded historians for centuries. In The Forbidden Tomb by Chris Kuzneski, the Hunters, an elite group assembled by an enigmatic billionaire, are tasked with finding the tomb. Following clues to Alexandria, they encounter hostile forces that will do anything to stop them. Before long, the treasure hunt becomes a deadly rescue mission that could take the lives of hundreds and leave a city in ruins. Andy Kaplow performs the book.
The desert didn't scare him. He knew the dangers of hiking alone in the Sahara, but he had been doing it for so many years that he was prepared for anything. At least he thought he was. A veteran explorer with more than 2 decades of experience, Dr. Cyril Manjani had taken all of the necessary precautions before leaving camp. He had notified his team of his travel plans and told them when he would return. He had packed food, water, a GPS unit, and a compass, and even some glow sticks in case his flashlight failed. They were the same essentials that he always packed before his nightly walks. His hike had nothing to do with adventure. He just needed some time to think. An expert in Egyptology, Manjani had handpicked the members of his team. Though most were graduate students, they represented the cream of the academic crop from some of the world's finest schools. Together, they covered a wide range of scholarly pursuits that might come in handy on his latest expedition. Manjani didn't want identical opinions on this project. He needed unique perspectives in multiple fields. They had been toiling in the desert for 3 long weeks before things started to get interesting. First, they had discovered a stone wall around the perimeter of an ancient site. Then came a series of small huts that had been almost perfectly preserved under the sand. Eventually, they had found a much larger structure that housed the desiccated remains of several soldiers and a mishmash of objects from several ancient cultures. That had been yesterday. Today's discovery was even more exciting. So much so that he had refused to leave it at camp. Resting atop a towering dune, Manjani drank from his thermos before tightening the drawstrings around his neck. The April breeze was chilly, and he was grateful for the warmth of his tea and his jacket. Staring out across the vast emptiness of the Sahara, he felt a sense of wonder wash over him. Undulating waves of sand stretched out for miles in every direction. Most saw the bleak terrain as an adversity that must be overcome, but Manjani saw it as a place of opportunity. The landscape was literally filled with the answers to mysteries that had gone unsolved for centuries. These were the moments that he cherished most. Nothing stirred his emotions in quite the same way. Manjani checked his watch. He had planned to be gone for 90 minutes at most, and he was quickly running out of time. Before heading back, he turned his attention to the nighttime sky. He was always amazed by how much the city lights obscured his view of the heavens, but out here, in the heart of the desert, the celestial bodies glowed against the darkest black he had ever seen. The contrast was so great that he swore he could see stars that he had never seen before. Though he would have preferred to stay on the dune a little longer, gazing at the panorama above, he felt a sudden chill run up his spine. He pulled his drawstrings tighter and cursed under his breath. He knew a sudden drop in temperature often preceded drastic changes in the weather, and out here, in the middle of nowhere, those changes could be deadly. Wasting no time, he started his journey back. The closer he got to camp, the more the breeze picked up strength. He covered his eyes as sand pelted his face, stinging like hordes of microscopic insects. The wind whistled past his ears, drowning out all other sounds around him. Despite the clear sky, Manjani could sense that things were about to turn nasty. As he crested the final dune, he was glad his journey was nearly over. Unfortunately, his nightmare had just begun.
That was The Forbidden Tomb by Chris Kozneski. Ben Mezrich has created his own addictive genre of nonfiction, chronicling fascinating stories of young geniuses making tons of money on the edge of impossibility, ethics, and morality. He's authored 12 books, including Bringing Down the House, the inside story of six MIT students who took Vegas for Millions, which spent 63 weeks on the Times bestseller list. His book, The Accidental Billionaires, The Founding of Facebook, A Tale of Sex, Money, Genius, and Betrayal, was adapted into the blockbuster movie The Social Network. While writing these true stories, he's done some pretty awesome things, like... During his research for Bringing Down the House, he taped $250,000 to his body and smuggled it through the airport security with some of the most notorious card counters in the world. While writing Ugly Americans, he visited exclusive Japanese-only underground sex clubs in Tokyo and juggled roadblocks and run-ins against the Japanese mafia. His new book, Seven Wonders, which we'll speak about today, is a departure of sorts, a high-stakes epic thriller that races around the world to unlock the mystery that links the seven wonders of the world. Welcome, Ben, and it's great to have you back with us on the Book Report.
Oh, thank you so much. I love it. Love it here, so it's awesome.
After all your nonfiction bestsellers, why fiction now?
You know, this came about kind of as a surprise to me. I've been writing nonfiction for a number of years now, and the director, Brett Ratner in Hollywood, he just did the big Hercules movie. He and I have been friends for many years, and he was a producer on my movie 21 about the Vegas kids. And basically, he was on the phone with me, and he said, you know, I've got an idea for a story, but it's fiction. Would you be interested? And that's how it all started. So it was kind of just a conversation, and then it became Seven Wonders.
Well, actually, what inspired you to use the seven wonders of the ancient world and the new seven wonders as the core of your story?
Well, I was a geeky kid growing up, and I was always kind of obsessed with things like the pyramids and the Sphinx and all of these crazy things that we've built thousands and thousands of years ago. And what Brett was talking about was the seven wonders of the modern world, which were the Taj Mahal, the Colosseum, more of the modern things. And as I was looking into it, I was trying to figure out a way to link all of these wonders. And it turns out there was a way to link them, and that's essentially how the book came about, is I figured out that there was something in common between all of these different wonders of the world. But yeah, there's two lists, the ancient and the modern, and this book takes place kind of in both of them.
Did you get to visit all the seven places?
I've been to many of them. I've been to, I would say, most of the modern seven wonders of the world. The ancient seven wonders are all gone except for the pyramids, where I've been, which are wild and incredible. You know, things like the Taj Mahal, the Colosseum, Machu Picchu. I think these are things people should go see. Some of the others are pretty neat. Petra in Jordan is one that most people forget, but it's that giant rock wall.
Did you ride a horse in there?
I did, yes. Rode with a group. But yeah, I'm not really an Indiana Jones type of person. I mean, if you look at me, I'm very pale and weak, and I don't really go outside that much. And so I'm not, you know, diving in headfirst and climbing things. But if it's the right kind of tour, I can do it.
And speaking of Indiana Jones, your main character, Jack Grady, is a swashbuckling field anthropologist. And because, as you write, the lab is where you end up when you can no longer hack it in the field. So am I off base to say he's an updated Indy?
Yeah, I mean, he is definitely a modern version of Indiana Jones. My goal is to create my own Indiana Jones. He's, you know, very out there. He's an anthropologist, but he kind of dives in. He's not the guy you see in a lab coat studying. He's the one who lives with the Yanomamo, or he lives with the Swat Pakhtun in Pakistan, and he goes from place to place. And as he uncovers these links in the Seven Wonders, he's able to sort of use the skills he's developed through anthropology to understand what's going on. And I actually took anthropology in college. It was sort of my minor. So I had spent a lot of time, you know, studying it. And then I wanted to sort of create a character that used all the things that I had learned.
The book begins at MIT in something called the Infinite Corridor. Is this for real?
Yeah, this is all real. There's a corridor that runs across MIT, and it runs for an incredibly long distance. And there's all these underground labs. MIT is a really interesting place. There's a lot of the things that we use today was developed there. I mean, but there's also this big military connection. You know, they developed radar there. They developed a lot of weapons that we use there. And so it's this environment where these incredibly geeky, super smart people work. But there's also kind of this darkness to it. I've always been fascinated by MIT. I mean, living in Boston, writing about the MIT college kids who beat Vegas. And so, yeah, the opening of the book takes place in an MIT lab.
Okay, I might mispronounce this, but what exactly is an enantiomer?
An enantiomer is an exact opposite, basically. It's like two hands. If you place them together, one is an enantiomer of the other. You know, it's an opposite. I don't know how to describe it without showing it. It's kind of difficult. And it's more of a scientific term than it is sort of, you know, anything else. But the idea, the central concept of the book is that if you were to make a map of the ancient wonders of the world, which I said are all gone now, most of them, and you made a map of the modern wonder of the world, and you placed them on top of each other, you actually find that they are a match, which is very weird, because one of the groups was chosen by, you know, Herodotus and then ancient Greek scholars as sort of a travel log, and the other group was voted on in a vote back in 2006, 2007. So it's weird that there's a link between them. But then again, you know, the mind looks for patterns. It's all about this kind of thing where you find patterns if you really look for them. And that's essentially where this starts.
How long did it take you to research this book?
I would say 6 months or so of pretty heavy research. My wife is essentially my main researcher. So we keep it in the family. Between the two of us, it was probably about a 6-month process.
The myth of the Amazons, the female warriors, is very central to your story. In your opinion, might they have actually existed?
Yeah, so the Amazons is interesting. I mean, they're considered mythological because there's no actual proof. But there's tons of ancient writings about Amazons, everything from Alexander's time and the dialogues that were kept back then or the different his stories from then, all the way to, you know, in the Brazilian rainforest, there's links to the Amazons. There's, which is why it's called the Amazon rainforest, there's a lot of different places where you can find mention of them. There's no proof that they ever existed, but I believe they probably did exist. There probably was this warrior class of women that had their own, you know, sort of culture that essentially was very fierce and then eventually died out. You know, they would cut off one breath so that they could throw their spears better. They would steal men from opposing tribes so that they could continue to raise the next generation. But they probably did exist. I mean, they weren't Wonder Woman running around with invisible airplanes and stuff, but there probably was a tribe of warrior women at one point in time.
Speaking of airplanes, would it be a spoiler to mention Amelia Earhart?
I mean, listen, I don't want to give too much away because this book does have a lot of strange mysteries in it. And as we're working on the movie right now, there's going to be things that you're not going to necessarily know, even if you've read the book when you watch the movie. But there is a link to Amelia Earhart in the movie and in the book. Yes.
And are you also writing the script for the movie?
No, the script's being written by Evan Spilotopoulos is his name. He wrote Hercules for Brett, which was just out. The one with The Rock, not the one with the other one. So he's working on it right now, and hopefully it will go into production within, you know, this coming year.
Will Jack Grady return in future adventures?
Yes, I'm working on a second book. I love this character. I mean, I feel like Indiana Jones was something that I grew up with that I love so much, and there hasn't really been a new one, you know? And I've always wanted to see that. I've always wanted to see a new version of Indiana Jones in a world where we live, in a modern world. And so my goal is to write at least three of them. I'm working on book two right now.
And do you yet know who's going to play him in the movie?
I don't. You know, there's been some mention of a couple people. There's a few people that I would love to see. I'd love to see like a Matthew McConaughey or someone of that kind of, you know, gravitas, I guess is the word. Someone like that to play it. But who knows? I mean, we'll see what happens when we get the script in.
And are you also working on another nonfiction book?
Yes, I have a very big nonfiction book coming out this coming, I guess it's May, June, so spring, summer. And it's sort of been kept under wraps. It's probably the biggest thing I've ever worked on. And it's, I can just say it's about Russian oligarchs. But it's a true story in the words of people who've never spoken before about some of the events that we see in the newspaper every day. So it should be pretty cool.
You also write books for kids. Tell us about that.
I do. I just had a kid's book come out and I'm writing the second one now. It's another series. It's kind of an Encyclopedia Brown type series. And it's about a geeky math science nerd kid who's 12 years old, and him and his buddies figure out a way to beat carnival games. And so it's essentially a younger version of Bringing Down the House, and it's called Bringing Down the Mouse. They go down to a big amusement park in Florida, and they take it down in this kind of scheme. It turns out most carnival games can be beaten by physics and math. So remember the little games where you throw a dart at a balloon or you try and get a coin on a plate? There are mathematical ways to actually beat those games. And so this is kind of aimed at kids, and kids don't like math. It's very hard to teach young boys math. And so part of this project was about, you know, getting math and statistics into 12-year-olds. I think it was so fun to write, and I'm working on another one. I want to write about 10 of them. It's going to be like Encyclopedia Brown type thing.
Any final thoughts about Seven Wonders?
I had so much fun writing Seven Wonders. I hope people take to it because I want to keep writing them. I think when the movie comes out, I think people will really gravitate towards it. Listen, there's mysteries in this world that we really have to look harder at. And the Seven Wonders of the World are one of those things that everyone kind of knows, but no one really knows much about. So hopefully people will read it.
Ben, I loved the book. It was a great romp. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, I appreciate it. Anytime. Thanks so much.
Now, let's listen to a sample of Seven Wonders, narrated by Luke Daniels.
Now that he was 7 years into a PhD in applied math computer science at MIT, his proclivities seemed little more than a nuisance. Besides, he wasn't the only doctoral candidate at the prestigious math science mecca who chose to eat his meals in his studio apartment, meticulously stacking his silverware when he was done. Nor, he assumed, was he the only programming guru to lock himself into his computer lab for 2 days, crafting algorithms and running subroutines because of something he'd stumbled into that didn't seem quite right. Though, to be accurate, the Level 4 security lab wasn't actually Jeremy's. Even though he'd effectively moved in over the past 48 hours, he didn't actually have the proper clearance to be using such expensive and sensitive equipment, especially on a project that had nothing to do with his PhD. But it had become evident that he didn't have access to enough processing power at his own workstation in a shared cubicle halfway across campus. On top of that, Jeremy had needed the satellite data, and everyone at MIT knew where you went when you needed satellite data. The warren of underground labs tucked beneath the infinite corridor were one of the university's worst-kept secrets, especially since some of the money the U.S. Defense Department had set aside to fund the high-tech bunkers was earmarked to hire undergrads as lab techs and engineers. It was one of those undergrads who had loaned Jeremy his security ID to get past the guard manning the elevators that led down from the corridor. One geek with glasses looked much like the next, not that anyone treated this place like Area 51. MIT's relationship with the Defense Department went all the way back to before World War II, when radar had been developed in secret campus labs much like this one. At MIT, working on the next generation of missile defense systems was like playing in the marching band, an extracurricular to fatten up your resume. The last thing Jeremy was afraid of, staring at the image on the giant screen, was getting caught in the lab without the proper clearance. It was the nature of a university full of introverts that nobody knew what anyone else was doing. To be fair, bathed in the glare of the impossible image on the screen, Jeremy was no longer sure he could even explain it to himself. Dr. Berman, the psychiatrist he'd most relied on through high school and college, might have insisted that Jeremy was having another one of his episodes, plunging deeper and deeper down the rabbit's hole of his mind, chasing patterns that only he could see. Even a perfectly normal human brain was built around a passion for patterns. It was part of the evolutionary process, a biological survival mechanism that had driven humanity to the top of the food chain. In Jeremy's case, the slightest hint of a numerical association could lead to near mental paralysis as his obsessive mind searched for connections that may or may not actually exist. And maybe in the beginning, Dr. Berman's diagnosis would have been correct. A normal person would not have turned what was essentially a stupid argument between brothers into a time-consuming diversion, employing enough computing power to launch a medium-sized war. A disagreement so petty and bizarre, it wouldn't even make sense beyond the confines of the twins' dysfunctional relationship. Why his brother Jack even felt it necessary to return to Boston once a year to mark the anniversary of their mother's death was unfathomable to Jeremy. The two of them had so little in common. Without an argument, they'd have nothing to say to each other at all. This one had been as pointless as ever. Jack had barely stepped off the plane when he'd started going on about his latest excursion, some sort of field research study at an archaeological dig site in Turkey. An anthropology fellow at Princeton who spent more time getting his passport stamped than in any classroom, Jack was always prattling on about his latest adventures. This time he was particularly excited because the dig site was at one of the ancient seven wonders of the world.
We've just heard Seven Wonders by Ben Mezrich. As dawn approaches in New York, literary agent Isabel Reed is turning the final pages of a mysterious, anonymous manuscript, racing through the explosive revelations about powerful people and long-hidden secrets about her own past. In Copenhagen, veteran CIA operative Hayden Gray has determined this sweeping story should never see the light of day. But suddenly, he's staring down the barrel of a gun. And in Zurich, the author himself is hiding in a shadowy expat life, trying to atone for a lifetime's worth of lies and betrayals. In The Accident by Chris Pavoni, these lives collide over the course of one long, desperate day. Careers and companies could be ruined, and everyone placed in mortal peril. The action rockets around Europe and across America with an intricate web of secrets stretching back a quarter century to a dark winding road in upstate New York, where the shocking truth about an accident is buried. Mozan Marno narrates.
It's just before dawn when Isabel Reed turns the final sheet of paper. Halfway down the page, her mouth falls open, her heartbeat quickens. Her eyes dart across each typescript line at a rapid-fire pace, accelerating as she moves through the final paragraph, desperate to arrive at a revelation to confirm her suspicions. She sucks in her breath and holds that breath for the last lines. Isabel stares at the final period, the little black dot of ink, staring. She lets out her breath. My God. Astounded at the enormity of the story, disappointed at the absence of the confirmation she was hoping for, furious at what it means, terrified at the dangers it presents, and, above all, heartbroken at the immensity of the betrayal. Betrayals. She puts the page down on the fat stack of paper that sits on the bedspread next to a crumpled soft pack of cigarettes and an overflowing crystal ashtray, a mildly snarky birthday present from a passive-aggressive colleague. She picks up the manuscript with both hands, flips it over, and uses her thumbs to align the pages. Her hands are trembling. She tries to steady herself with a deep breath and sets the straightened pile of pages in her lap. There are four words centered at the top of the page. "The Accident," by Anonymous. Isabel stares across the room, off into the black nothingness of the picture window on the opposite wall, its severe surface barely softened by the half-drawn shades, an aggressive void invading the cocoon of her bedroom. The room is barely lit by a small, bullet-shaped reading sconce mounted over the headboard, aiming a concentrated beam of light directly at her. In the window, the light's reflection hovers above her face, like a tiny sun illuminating the top of her head, creating a halo. An angel. Except she's not. She can feel her body tense and her jaw tighten and her shoulders contract in a spasm of rage. She tries to suppress it, bites her lip, brings herself under the flimsiest tether of control. Isabel draws aside the bedspread, struggles to a sitting position. It's been hours since she has shifted her body in any appreciable way, and her legs and back are stiff and achy. Old, if she had to choose a word for her joints. Her legs dangle over the side of the mattress, her toes searching for the fleece-lined slippers. Along the wall, long slivers of aluminum shelves, hundreds of horizontal feet, are filled with neat stacks of manuscripts, their authors' names written with thick black Sharpie into the sides of the stacks of pages. Tens of thousands of pages of proposed books of every sort, promising a wide assortment of entertainment and information, produced with a broad range of skill levels. These days, everyone younger than Isabel seems to read manuscripts and proposals on e-readers, quite a few of those older, too. But she feels uncomfortable, unnatural, sitting there holding a little device in her hands. Isabel is of the generation that's just old enough to be congenitally uncomfortable with new technologies. When she started her first job, she didn't have a computer at her desk. A year later, she did. Maybe next year she'll start using one of those things. But for now, she's still reading on paper, turning pages, making notes with pens, surrounding herself with stacks of paper, like bricks, bunkered against the relentless onslaught of the future. And for the accident, she didn't even have a choice. Because although nearly all new projects are now delivered to her office electronically, this submission was not. She shuffles down the hall, through the darkness, turns on the kitchen lights and the coffee machine, switched from auto on, which is set to start brewing an hour from now, to on, and the small television, filling the silent, lonely apartment with humming electronic life. Isabel had been reading frantically, hoping to discover the one assertion that rang untrue, the single mismatched thread that would unravel the whole narrative, growing increasingly discouraged as page one at the office in the morning became page 200-something at home in the evening. She fell asleep sometime after 11, more than halfway through, then woke again at 2, unable to quiet her mind, anxious to get back to it.
We've just heard The Accident by Chris Pavone. Donna Leon's critically acclaimed Commissario Guido Brunetti series has attracted international listeners with its fearlessness in exploring politics, morality, and contemporary Italian culture. This is a new addition to the Book Report's roster, one I think we'll find worthy. In By Its Cover, book 23 in the series, Commissario Brunetti gets a frantic call from the director of a prestigious Venetian library. Someone has stolen pages out of several rare books. After a round of questioning, the case seems clear. The culprit must be the man who requested the volumes, an American professor from a Kansas university. The problem? The man fled the library earlier that day, and after checking his credentials, it seems the American professor never existed.
As the investigation proceeds, the suspects multiply, and when a seemingly harmless theologian turns up brutally murdered, Brunetti must question his expectations about what makes a man innocent or guilty. David Colacci narrates.
He thought of the procedures he had gone through at the libraries in the city whenever he consulted a book and asked, "You have records of the people who use the books, don't you?" Was she surprised that a policeman should ask such a question? That he knew about libraries? It certainly took her some time to answer.
"Of course."
Well, that put him in his place, didn't it?
"We're checking on that."
"Have you found who did it?" Brunetti asked. There followed an even longer pause.
"A researcher, we think," she said, then added, as if Brunetti had accused her of negligence, "He had the proper identification."
He heard the response of any bureaucrat beginning to formulate a defense at the first whisper of an accusation of negligence. "Dottoressa," Brunetti began, using what he hoped was his most persuasive and professional voice, "we'll need your help in identifying him. The sooner we find him, the less time he'll have to sell what he's taken." He saw no reason to spare her this reality.
"But the books are destroyed," she said, sounding anguished, as at the death of a loved person.
To a librarian, damage was as bad as theft, he imagined. Changing his voice to that of authority, he said,
"I'll be there as soon as I can, Dottoressa. Please, do not touch anything."
Before she could protest, he added, "And I'd like to see the identification he gave you." When there was no response, he replaced the phone. Brunetti remembered that the library was on the Zattere, but the exact location eluded him now. He returned his attention to the guard and told him,
"If anyone wants me, I've gone to the Biblioteca Merula. Call Vianello and tell him to go over with two men to take fingerprints."
Outside, he found Foa, arms folded, legs crossed at the ankles, leaning against the railing that ran along the canal. His head was tilted back, and his eyes were closed against the early spring sun. But when Brunetti approached, the pilot asked,
"Where can I take you, Commissario?"
before opening his eyes.
"The Biblioteca Merula," he said.
As if finishing Brunetti's sentence, Foa continued,
"Dorso Duro, 3429.
"How do you know that?"
"My brother-in-law and his family live in the next building, so that has to be the address," the pilot answered. "I feared for a moment that the lieutenant had made some new rule that obliged you to learn all the addresses in the city by heart. Anyone who's grown up on boats knows where everything in the city is, sir. Better than a GPS," Foa said, tapping his forehead with his finger.
He pushed himself away from the railing and made towards the boat, but stopped mid-stride and turned to Brunetti.
"You ever hear what became of them, sir?"
"Of what?" a confused Brunetti asked.
"The GPSs."
"Which GPSs?"
"The ones that were ordered for the boats," Foa answered.
Brunetti stood still, waiting for the explanation.
"I was talking to Martini a few days ago," Foa continued, naming the officer in charge of procurement,
the man to consult to have a radio fixed or get a new flashlight.
"He showed me the invoice and asked me if I knew whether they were any good or not. The model that had been ordered."
That was By Its Cover by Donna Leon. Paula Hawkins draws inspiration from Hitchcock's Rear Window in her debut psychological thriller, The Girl on the Train. Rachel takes the same commuter train every morning and night. Every day, she rattles over the same tracks, flashes past the same stretch of cozy suburban homes.
And every day, the train stops at the same signal, and Rachel seems the same couple, breakfasting on their roof deck, living the perfect life Rachel craves for herself. She looks forward to observing this household every morning, even makes up names and narratives for its residents. Then one day, Rachel sees someone new in their garden, and soon after, the woman who'd lived there disappears. Unable to keep the information to herself, Rachel goes to the police, and in the process is drawn into the lives of the couple. But the police accuse Rachel of being unreliable, and Rachel's ex-husband's new wife has been spreading stories about her. Soon, Rachel is in over her head, intricately entangled in the details of the investigation as well as in the lives of everyone involved. Has she put others in danger? Has she done more harm than good? An ensemble cast performs the book.
I wanted to talk to someone. The need for contact must have been overwhelming, and there was no one I could call except for Tom. There's no one I want to talk to except for Tom. The call log on my phone says I rang four times at 11:02, 11:12, 11:54, 12:09. Judging from the length of the calls, I left two messages. He may even have picked up, but I don't remember talking to him. I remember leaving the first message. I think I just asked him to call me. That may be what I said in both of them, which isn't too bad. The train shudders to a standstill at the red signal, and I look up. Jess is sitting on her patio, drinking a cup of coffee. She has her feet up against the table and her head back, sunning herself. Behind her, I think I can see a shadow. Someone moving. Jason. I long to see him, to catch a glimpse of his handsome face. I want him to come outside, to stand behind her the way he does, to kiss the top of her head. He doesn't come out, and her head falls forward. There is something about the way she is moving today that seems different. She is heavier, weighed down. I will him to come out to her, but the train jolts and slogs forward, and still there is no sign of him. She's alone. And now, without thinking, I find myself looking directly into the house, and I can't look away. The French doors are flung open, light streaming into the kitchen. I can't tell, I really can't, whether I'm seeing this or imagining it. Is she there at the sink washing up? Is there a little girl sitting in one of those bouncy baby chairs up there on the kitchen table? I close my eyes and let the darkness grow and spread until it morphs from a feeling of sadness into something worse. A memory. A flashback. I didn't just ask him to call me back. I remember now. I was crying. I told him that I still loved him, that I always would. Please, Tom, please, I need to talk to you. I miss you. No.
We've just heard The Girl on the Train by Paula Hawkins. In the highly anticipated The Black-Eyed Blonde, Benjamin Black channels Raymond Chandler and brings Philip Marlowe back to life for a new adventure on the mean streets. It's the early 1950s. A young, beautiful client is shown into Marlowe's office. She hopes he can find her former lover, one Nico Peterson. As soon as Marlowe sets off on his search, he discovers Peterson's disappearance is merely the first in a series of bewildering events. Soon, he is tangling with one of Bay City's richest families and developing a singular appreciation for how far they will go to protect their fortune. Dennis Boutsakaris narrates.
When I struck a match and offered it across the desk, she leaned forward and bent her head with dipped lashes and touched a fingertip briefly to the back of my hand. I admired her pearl-pink nail polish, but didn't say so. She sat back in the chair and crossed her legs under the narrow blue skirt and gave me that coolly appraising look again. She was taking her time in deciding what she should make of me. "I want you to find someone," she said. "Right. Who would that be?" "A man named Peterson. Nico Peterson. Friend of yours?" He used to be my lover. If she expected me to swallow my teeth in shock, she was disappointed. Used to be? I said. Yes, he disappeared rather mysteriously without even saying goodbye. When was this? 2 months ago. Why had she waited so long before coming to me? I decided not to ask her, or not yet, anyway. It gave me a funny feeling being looked at by those cool eyes behind the veil's transparent black mesh. It was like being watched through a secret window, watched and measured. You say he disappeared, I said. You mean out of your life or altogether? Both, it seems. I waited for more, but she only leaned back a farther inch or so and smiled again. That smile, it was like something she had set a match to a long time ago and then left to smolder on by itself. She had a lovely upper lip, prominent, like a baby's, soft-looking and a little swollen, as if she had done a lot of kissing recently, and not kissing babies either. She must have sensed my unease about the veil and put up a hand now and lifted it away from her face. Without it, the eyes were even more striking, a lustrous shade of seal black that made something catch in my throat. So, tell me about him, I said, your Mr. Peterson. Tallish, like you, dark, handsome in a weak sort of way. Wears a silly mustache, Don Amici style. Dresses nicely, or used to, when I had a say in the matter. She had taken a short ebony holder from her purse and was fitting the black Russian into it. Deft, those fingers. Slender, but with strength in them. What does he do? I asked. She glanced at me with a steely twinkle. For a living, you mean? She pondered the question. He sees people, she said. This time I leaned back in my chair. How do you mean? I asked. Just what I say. Practically every time I saw him, he was about to leave urgently. I gotta see this guy. There's this guy I gotta go see. She was a good mimic. I was beginning to get a picture of Mr. Peterson. He didn't sound like her type. A busy fellow, then, I said. His busyness had few results, I'm afraid. At any rate, not results that you'd notice, or that I noticed, anyway. If you ask him, he'll tell you he's an agent to the stars. The people he had to see so urgently were usually connected to one of the studios. It was interesting, the way she kept switching tenses. All the same, I had the impression that he was very much the past for her, this Peterson bird. So why did she want him found? He's in the movie business? I asked. I wouldn't say in, sort of scrabbling at the edges with his fingertips. He had some success with Mandy Rogers. Should I know the name? Starlet, ingenue, Nico would say. Think Jean Harlow without the talent. Jean Harlow had talent? She smiled at that. Nico is firmly of the belief that all his geese are swans. I got out my pipe and filled it. It struck me that the tobacco blend I was using had some Cavendish in it. I decided not to share this happy coincidence with her, imagining the jaded smile and twitch of disdain at the corner of her mouth that would greet it. Known him long, your Mr. Peterson? I asked. Not long. How long would not long be? She shrugged, which involved a fractional lift of her right shoulder. A year? She made it a question. Let me see, it was summer when we met. August, maybe. Where was that? That you met, I mean. The Kawia Club. Do you know it? It's in the Palisades. Polo grounds, swimming pools, lots of bright, shiny people. The kind of place that wouldn't let a Seamus like you put his foot inside the electronically controlled gates. That last bit she didn't say, but I heard it all the same.
That was The Black-Eyed Blonde by Benjamin Black. Readers, thrillers are pure escapism. As W.H. Auden said, they speak the dream language of the heart. They reassure us that cruelty, violence, and suffering have causes and rational intentions, and that the forces of right and justice will struggle against them. In the majority of cases, the world is back on its axis by book's end. For more titles in genres across the spectrum, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.